Wisdom is a precious and valuable possession that we can possess, but not all do. The book of Proverbs, of course, is a book of wisdom. And in that book, he is again and again saying that wisdom would do this as opposed to foolishness. And many, many directions, many, many practical applications are made in the book of Proverbs of wisdom and what wisdom would do. In the process of doing that, the writer tells us that therefore we should choose wisdom above folly or foolishness. And we should choose, in fact, wisdom above many other possessions that we might acquire. Wisdom will, in fact, save us from ourselves. When we are left to ourselves, we are destined to self-destruct. In prosperity, in acquiring some inheritance and a windfall profit of some sort, we might be filled with pride and arrogance and self-sufficiency and led away from trust in God. On the other side of it, in affliction and difficult times, we might become bitter and even depressed and even despair about life. One who is oppressed himself might seek vindication and justice and become resentful and bitter toward others. And all of us, of course, must guard against either of these circumstances. Wisdom will save us from that. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, he says in verse 11 that wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. I believe what he's saying in that is that our defense, even against ourselves, and perhaps especially against ourselves, is wisdom. And that wisdom would be useful in times of prosperity because it would keep our heads level and not allow us to become self-sufficient. And it would be helpful in times of despair or times of oppression, because it would help us keep perspective on life and trust God and follow Him regardless of the way things are going. Wisdom helps us understand God's part in the world, God's part in the working of things that affect our lives. In the next verse, in verse 13 of Ecclesiastes 7, he says, "Consider the work of God. For who can make straight what He has made crooked?" When you consider anything that God has done, or anything that God would do, who would there be among us who would change that? Who would there be who would straighten something God has made crooked? Who would there be who would make crooked something God has made straight? In the book of Job, of course, is a great example of someone who had to deal with both sides of life. The good with the evil. In Job in chapter 2, in verse 9, his wife said to him, "Do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die." Can you imagine a wife who would suggest such a thing to a righteous husband? And yet she is in despair. She is seeing the one whom she loves probably more than any other suffer. Suffer more than she can bear, and so her suggestion is legitimate, at least as far as her own wisdom would say. The easiest way out. If you curse God, then He might strike you dead. So curse God and die. That would be relief. Well, that fails in many respects to understanding and knowing God's working and God's control. And in verse 10, he said to her, "You speak as the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God and shall not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job had a perspective about life that was willing and able to look at the bad with the good. Shall we not on the one hand accept the good from God, and then when hard times come, do we blame Him? Don't be so foolish as to lose perspective about things in life. Oh, it's easy to believe in God and easy to think that, well, I'm a believer, I'm a Christian, I'm trusting God when things are in good order. My family's well, my family is doing as they ought to do, all is well. The church is in good shape. But what about the times when the family is not all together as they ought to be? What about the times when the health is decaying? What about the times when financial problems arise? What about the times when there are problems in the church? Do we begin then to blame God? Consider the work of God. Who can straighten what He has made crooked? Or for that matter, the reverse would also be true. But in the day of prosperity, be joyful. The advice is then to take things as they come. When you prosper, rejoice in that. Accept that as a gift from God. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so the man can find nothing that will happen after him. In the Scriptures, we find many references to the good that God would give to His people. In Deuteronomy chapter 26, if I can find it in my Bible, my pages seem to be stuck. In Deuteronomy 26, verse 11, so you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given to you and your house, and you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. The advice given to those people is exactly that of Ecclesiastes 7. When you look at the good, every good thing that the Lord has given to you, when you look at the good that is given to those who are in your house, the Levite or the stranger who might be staying there with you, rejoice. Be happy in those things. And you look in the New Testament and you see in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus in Matthew chapter 6 is saying, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own thing. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. You look at life and you understand there are worries. There are things that would cause people to worry, except for the fact of the existence of God and the care that God gives to His people. And therefore, there is reason of God's people, for God's people, to rejoice in what God does, to know that God is controlling it all. Romans chapter 8 is an interesting passage in that it is saying to us we have a very intimate and personal relationship with God. And the way that we know that, and the description of that in this chapter, is that God has given to us His Spirit to dwell in us. And those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. If we are children, he says, then we are heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. But then the very next line says, if indeed we also suffer together with Him, that we may also be glorified with Him. And in verse 18 of this chapter, Romans 8, he says, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed to us. So getting and bringing things into perspective is that God blesses His people. And when He blesses us and we prosper at His hand, there is reason to rejoice and be glad. And when we suffer, there is reason to remember that life right here and life right now in no way compares with eternal life. The sufferings of the present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed to us. And that, of course, is through Jesus Christ. So the sound basis of handling adversity is the same as the reason why we rejoice in prosperity, and that is God. Look at Philippians chapter 4 with me for just a moment. Beginning in verse 10, Paul is discussing himself and lessons that he has learned about life. Philippians 4, verse 10. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's the kind of confidence that we need. And yet in life, whereas it's easy to rejoice in the prosperity, in the adversity, our minds are skewed to one direction or another, and we lose sight of the very precious and valuable things that are needful for us to focus on. Paul is saying, look, you can do it. I can do all things. I can abound, and I can deal with the abundance of things, and I learn how to deal with need and want. I've learned both sides of it because I've learned the dependence on Christ. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. And you can too. And I can. We can do those things. Deal with life in an acceptable way to make life productive regardless of what affects our lives, because we're using the strength of Christ who works in us. 2 Corinthians 12 is a passage where you look at things and something that, going back to what Solomon had said earlier, can you straighten what God has made crooked? Here's a situation where there is something crooked as far as how it affected Paul's life and what he would wish to change. He prayed about it, which was the right thing to do. But look at how things took place and transpired in his life. 2 Corinthians 12, beginning verse 7. And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. There have been all kinds of speculation. It's a curious thing that people really would like to know what that thorn in the flesh was. And so there are guesses and speculations about that. But that's not the important thing. A person might find out what the thorn was and not find out what the lesson is in the passage. Paul says, concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Now, I don't believe there's anyone who would say that's not a hard lesson. Well, there's no challenge to that. There is a challenge to that. That is a challenging thing to us in life. Dealing with adversity, with weakness, with sickness, with problems, in a way that would say, I'm trusting God, and in my weakness, His power can be manifested. That's Paul's thinking. That's the lesson he learned. It's a lesson that we can use again and again and again, because we have those times of weakness. Back to Ecclesiastes 7. In verse 14, he says that really, the thing to remember is that ultimately, God is in control of all things. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find nothing that will happen after him. I have seen all things in my days of vanity. Now, there's a different problem. Similar, but slightly different. I've seen all things in the days of vanity, he says, that there is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in wickedness. What do you think of that? How does that strike you? Well, in the first place, we know the passages where Jesus says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And we know cases like that of Stephen and James, who died as martyrs, giving their life because of their faith. We know of others, such as Paul, who suffered many afflictions because of his righteousness. But that's really not the idea here. The thought here is that in spite of the righteousness and in spite of the wickedness, there is the one, on the one hand, the righteous suffering, not as a martyr, but just in normal circumstances. And there is the wicked person prospering and living a life of ease, not because of his wickedness, but in spite of his wickedness. And what we know from the Scriptures, well, just listen as I quickly will read through some of the statements about being righteous and what God says about the value of that, even for life that's now. In Psalm 34, he says, "Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil and do good and seek peace and pursue it." You want to live a good life, a long life, a happy life? Okay, live righteously. Keep your tongue from evil. Speak no guile. Depart from evil. In Psalm 55 and verse 23 he says, "But you, O God, shall bring them down to the pit of destruction. Bloodthirsty and deceitful men shall not live out half their days, but I will trust in you." On the one hand, God says, the righteous live the long life. The wicked live half, will not even live half their days. Proverbs 9, verses 10 and 11, he says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, and years of life will be added to you." Proverbs 10 and verse 27, "The fear of the Lord prolongs days, and the years of the wicked will be shortened." And there are passages in the New Testament which give the same kind of promises. For example, Ephesians 6 says, "Honor your father and mother," which is the first commandment with a promise, "that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth." Well, God is saying to us that the righteous have the long, happy life, and the wicked have their days shortened. And yet Solomon observes a righteous man's life cut short and a wicked man prolonging his days. Why? And how do we reconcile the inconsistencies? Well, we must understand several things about this. First of which is the significance of life itself, and a relative understanding of what really is important in living. And that would be that eternal life is far better than physical life. Spiritual living, even though death would come early to a child of God, those who die in the Lord are said to be blessed. So understanding that relationship of eternal life and physical life or temporary life would truly help our understanding. But there's more to this, because he really, in these promises, is talking about life, long life, on earth.
Well, it is not a universal thing. Observation tells you that. It is not universal that the righteous man will live to be 80 or 90 or 100. It's not always the case. A young, righteous person may drown in a boating accident or a swimming accident. He may be killed in a car wreck. He may even contract some deadly disease and die of that. Young. Righteous, by all appearances, so. But died at an early age. A wicked person, living in his wickedness, unscrupulous in many, many ways, yet living a long life, prosperous life. Unfair, isn't it? Well, to be sure, it does go against the norm as God describes it in the verses we read. But it does happen. What kind of lessons then? Why is this consistency allowed to happen? Well, one of the reasons why would be because God is saying to us, look, don't just live and don't just do what you do so that you'll live a long life and that you'll be attached to life here on earth and think that, well, I can be righteous and therefore by my righteousness I'll extend my life and I'll have 80 or 90 or 100 years to enjoy. Don't lose your perspective about the eternal things in comparison to the natural or the physical, the temporary things. That's what he's saying in the next verses. Verse 16, he says, do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Is it possible to be too righteous? Is it possible to be too wise? Well, according to what he says, it is. But not in the sense of, well, you can do too much good. You can serve the Lord too much. He's not saying that. But he is saying that if you think by becoming a religious fanatic, you are forcing God to bless you and make you have long life and happy life, and that you're putting the pressure on God to say, oh, look at him, he's so righteous. And to be impressed by your life. And if you think that by your wisdom you're outwitting God, and that you figured out God's work because you're so smart that you did that, well, you are so foolish to think that you can maneuver and manipulate God in such a way. And so the point that Solomon is making is that you do not do the good things and learn the things that would make you wise and intelligent and bring knowledge to you just so you can maneuver and make things happen the way you want them to happen, so that you can find enjoyment and happiness of life and prosperity and long life. The other side is also true. Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? If you think, well, look at this fellow. He's living a long life and just doing as he pleases. Everything's going his way. Well, I'll follow his example. If you look at his life and think that that's the lesson about life, and that that's the way to happiness, you're missing some things. You're overlooking some very important lessons that need to be observed. It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other. For he who fears God will escape them all. In the 8th chapter, verse 12, he says about the same thing. Though a sinner does evil 100 times, and his days are prolonged, yet surely I know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. Oh, the sinner may prosper. And as I look at it, he may have the best of everything.
that the world has to offer. But if I really am intelligent, if I'm really wise, I'll see that there's more to life than what might be observed now, what might appear to be the case. And that the basis of that good life, and the basis then of life worth living, however many the days, and whatever the income, is fearing God. He who fears God will truly prosper. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. That's just a comparison. There's not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. In the real sense and in the absolute sense, that's true. That statement is made in both the Old and New Testaments, and it's a reminder to us that we need God, and we desperately need Him, because we cannot save ourselves, and we cannot work out our own problems. And yet we live in a time, we live among people who think they have learned so much, and they've gained so much knowledge, because it is multiplying all the time, to where they would make such an arrogant statement. God will not save us. We will save ourselves. That statement is made by humanists because they trust in human abilities and human knowledge and human strength. Well, humans don't have the strength that we need to save ourselves. In whatever way you might define save or salvation, we do not have that ability. When left to ourselves, apart from God, we are destined to destruction. Well, is there one who then would learn this kind of lesson? Well, he says in verse 21, also, do not take to heart everything people say. This is an interesting sort of a parenthesis put in here. Lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. And isn't it so? He's using curse in a loose and a general way. But isn't it so that if you heard everything that others say about you, that you probably would rather not? And isn't it so that you have not always, when you've spoken of other people, spoken favorably of them? And would you like for them to know everything that you've said about them? Well, there's a lesson in that, truly. One is, of course, that you need to be very careful about what you say. And for that matter, what you think of other people, and how you judge them, and how critical you may be of them. But I think the lesson really that Solomon is getting across is that you cannot depend on what others say and what others think of you and whether they're critical or whether they're complimentary of you. That's not going to determine who you are and what your life is worth. If someone criticizes you and that comes to your attention maybe by a second or third person along the way who heard it and reports it back to you, so what? You know, that might touch your feelings, might hurt your feelings some. But does that make your day or break your day? Does that make or break your life? You can live and must live independent of the evaluations of others, but very dependent on the relationship that you have with God. In verses 23 through 29, the end of this chapter, I'd like to just kind of read through it with you, observing a couple of things as we go. But he makes some interesting statements about wisdom, observations he's made about life, some things in that can be useful and valuable to us. All this I have proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? If you want wisdom, where do you get it? If you truly want to be wise, how do you arrive at that wisdom? James says, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. You want to be wise? You want to understand things and try to put things into perspective and try to make wise judgments, try to give advice or counsel to others? You want to know how to deal with prosperity on the one hand and adversity on the other? You want to know how to keep things in perspective, in focus, and keep your life the way it ought to be? You want wisdom? Ask God. That's where you find it. But that seems so, who can trust that? That seems so iffy and so questionable. How do you know if you really are getting this wisdom? How can you tell if you're really wise and behaving wise? Well, obviously, God doesn't just kind of zap this one because He asked him and that one because He asked him and not give any wisdom to others. It's not just a magical, mystical zapping of wisdom into the mind or the heart of a person. Wisdom likewise comes from the pages of God's truth. Ask God and look into what He says with your mind opened up to the mind of God, with your heart a fertile field where the seed of the kingdom can be sown, fresh every day to grow new fruit that will be born in many fold for God's use, God's purpose. Ask God, and then seek to know from God. How foolish it would be to ask God and expect Him to put it on a billboard someplace along the highway that you drive back and forth to work. How foolish it would be to ask God for wisdom and expect that in a dream in the night He would tell you how all the answers to your circumstances and needs in life. But how wise it would be and how perceptive it would be to ask God and then go to the source of God's wisdom, the Bible. Learn it, study it, analyze it carefully, and then bring it personally into application into your life. And you'll find wisdom more and more and more from God by that process. He says in verse 25, I applied my heart to know, to search and seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even the foolishness of madness. Solomon is just looking everywhere at everything, wanting to know the good and the bad and everything. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Here's what I found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I found. He's saying, you just line up 1,000 men in the earth, randomly select 1,000 men. Observe them. See what kind of character they have. See how trustworthy they are. What kind of integrity. You find one out of 1,000. That's what he ought to be. Choose 1,000 women and line them up. And you don't find any. That's Solomon's observation. A woman among all these I have not found. Now Solomon, remember, is writing from a very bitter past. He is writing, in fact, having known 1,000 women, literally so. Being either married to them or having them as mistresses, concubines. And those 1,000 women whom he knew, not one of them was righteous. Not one of them tried to encourage him to be faithful to God. Not one of them was the kind of woman of love and concern. Selfish. Concerned about what she might get from him. And so his observation would be, not one in 1,000. That's not always the case. And that's not the point is not to say you can't find a good woman anywhere. But it is certainly true. The writer in Proverbs 31 says, who can find a virtuous wife? Almost with the question of, has there ever been one? Could you find one? Who might find her? Not as though she didn't exist, but setting a very high standard, a very high ideal for women to aspire to, women to hold in, as a goal. That's the kind of person I need to be, and that's the kind of person I want to be. Her price indeed is far above rubies, partly because she is so unique. Truly this only I have found, he finishes this chapter, verse 29, that God made man upright, and they've sought out many schemes. When you conclude this chapter, it concludes on a sour note. It looks at life from a sort of a pessimistic standpoint. It looks at life as though there's little hope about living. But please remember that what he had said earlier is really the lesson of it all. When you see that there is this despair about living, when you look at 1 out of 1,000 men and none out of 1,000 women, for all have just made their own schemes and their devices, and even though God has made them upright. When you look at things as though there is so much inconsistency, the righteous man his life is cut short, he is suffering, and the wicked man is prospering and he has long life. When you look at life and so much seems to be out of focus, there's just one thing that brings it into perspective and brings it into focus. That is not how others think of you. And that is not what you think of others. But it is what God thinks of you and what you think of God. Your perception of the Creator is crucial to the way you live each day. Because if you have doubts of His existence, those doubts lead you to many, many questions about life itself. If you do not doubt His existence, but yet doubt maybe portions of the Bible as being true, in effect you are doubting Him and doubting His power and His ability. And that leads you to many questions as well. If you have trouble comprehending that there could be an eternal creature, an almighty creature, one who is not bound by time and space as you and I are, that dimension or these dimensions do not have their effect and their limitations on Him. Do not grapple so much with, is that possible? But accept the fact that it is not only possible, but it is true, and with God all things are possible. Do not limit God in your own thinking about Him as though He were like you and me. He is not like we. Rather, we must be like He is. Not physically, but spiritually and eternally. And so we can say with Paul, as he wrote in 2 Corinthians 4, that the momentary light affliction is but for a moment. It truly is momentary. And it truly is light when viewed in terms of the perspective of everything that's involved in life. Because we do not look at the things that are seen, but we look at the things that are not seen. And as he says in the 5th chapter of 2 Corinthians, we walk by faith and not by sight. And so the one thing that will bring everything into focus and bring your life where it ought to be and make your life worth living is that thought of the relationship you have with an eternal God, the Creator, and your concept of Him, your thinking of Him, and whether or not you truly fear Him is what your life is all about and what it is built upon. Now perhaps you fear Him, but you've not realized it before. Perhaps you believe Christ and you've not really acted on that before. Perhaps you realize that you need to. If you'll open your books to the song that was announced, I want to encourage you not so much to look around you, but to look inside yourself and look above you at God and creation that He's made, and the revelation of His mind to you, and how awesome that must be that this Creator, the one with so much power that by the breath of His mouth He could speak all things into existence, that God knows each one of us. He knows you and me by name and concerns Himself with each one of us. And the question then is to you, are you just going to live apart from Him, thinking that you truly could? Or are you going to come to Him, live in Him and He in you, so that you can truly be the kind of person and have the kind of life that is worth living? Why not come while we stand and sing together?